This talk is given by Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society and is given freely for your enjoyment. It was recorded in the Netherlands during the spring of 2010. For more information, go to againstthestream.org.
So I wanted to talk tonight about something that would be both useful for people who are just in the middle of their retreat, and also for people who are at the end of their retreat period. And I thought, well, couldn't go wrong with something like the Four Noble Truths. Always appropriate for any phase of life and of retreat. I think it's important to understand the first truth, the Pali word, the Buddha's language. He used the term dukkha. Sometimes Buddhism gets translated that the first truth, noble truth, is that life is suffering. And I think that is a mistake. That's not quite the real understanding of dukkha. Dukkha can be translated as something like suffering or unsatisfactoriness or difficulty, dissatisfaction. There's an American monk in the Thai tradition, lives in Southern California, Bhikkhu Tanissaro. He goes by the name Ton Jeff. He translates dukkha as stress, rather than life is suffering. Life is stressful. There is stress in our lives. There is difficulty. All of the truths are tasks. They're not philosophy. The Four Noble Truths is not Buddhist philosophy. It is a action. It's not to be believed, like I believe in the Four Noble Truths. It's to be the first truth, to be known fully. The Buddha says suffering, stress, the unsatisfactory nature of both pleasure and pain in this impermanent world, sickness, old age, death, loss, grief, the difficult emotions, dukkha, can be known fully. And referring to his own awakening as he's teaching this path to others, he says, has been known fully. That's important for us, your first task. Again, one of the reasons why the Buddha's Dharma is so-called counter-instinctual, because our instincts are to sort of avoid the suffering, not to know it fully, not to look directly at the difficulties, but to maybe skim over the surface or do whatever we can to avoid the difficulties. Where the Buddha's teaching begins with knowing fully the nature of all of the difficulties in your life. Turn towards them. Know them fully. It's one of the beautiful things about meditation, about coming on retreat like this. Turning off the television and the music, the books and magazines and conversations, all of the things that let us stay sort of just above the full depth of our dukkha. You come here and you sit and it reveals itself. Oh, I am stressed about the future. I'm stressed about the past. I'm stressed about the present. This being human is challenging business, difficult. know it fully, sitting and walking, paying attention to the breath, to the body, to the feeling tones. The four foundations of mindfulness allow us to know fully the truth of what it's like to be you. Now, it's not that all life is dukkha, because also there is sukha. There is joy, there is pleasure, there is beauty. Sukha, dukkha. Pleasure, sorrow. There is both. But of course, in Buddhism we focus often on the negative, because as the second noble truth shows us, by understanding the cause of suffering, the cause of dukkha, then we can get to a place where there is less dukkha and there is more ease, there is more joy, there is more happiness. Because much of the dukkha is covering the happiness that is available. Second noble truth, there is a cause for a lot of the suffering in our life. It's caused by three things. Maybe more than three, but the Buddha put them in three categories. First, this pervasive, universal craving for life to be different than it is. And the Buddha primarily talked about that, like we've spoken about several times during the retreat, as craving for pleasant experience and aversion to unpleasant experience. Wanting the pleasure to come and last, and wanting the pain to go away and stay away. But because that's not actually our experience, we're unhappy a lot of the time. Because the pleasure never lasts long enough and the pain keeps coming, whether we like it or not. So we live a lot of our lives in this suffering, in this dissatisfaction, out of harmony with reality, constantly wishing life were different than it is, wanting more, wanting less, wanting different, craving and stuck in a delusion of I'll be happy when I finally am able to create the right circumstances for myself. Often we never realize, I think most people never realize, that you'll never create the right circumstances for more than a temporary period of time. Those right circumstances, when you get everything that you want, there's another craving that arises. It's like, are you familiar with that game where you have the hammer, and you, like for children at the amusement arcades, and you pop the, like something on the mole on the head? Have you ever seen something like this? And then you pop it, but then another one pops up. And every time you bonk the thing on the head, another one comes. And no matter what, like you just can't. You do it here, and it comes there, and you do it there, and it comes here. What is that called? Pop a mole?
Whack a mole.
Whack a mole. The old whack a mole. No matter how many cravings we satisfy or we renounce, another one arises. I don't know if this is such a good example or not, but I at one point was reading something about how Bill Gates, the American computer guy, in the beginning, whenever he started with the computer science, he said, if I can just make $1 million, I'll be happy and feel successful. And he made $1 million very early in his career. And then he said, well, maybe $100 million, and that would really make me happy. And then it was $1 billion, and I don't know how many billions he's made. Several billion. And always with that feeling of, more will be better. This is cool, but more would be better. I'll really be happy when I have more. But I don't know that's so different from us. Maybe we don't have such high expectations. Maybe your desires are not as grand as that, but something. I'll be happy when I get a new pair of shoes. The next vacation, whatever it is for you that you think is going to really work next time. Craving is endless, built in to us. Not your fault. Not personal. It is not self. It's what these human bodies do. It's what this human mind does to survive. Perhaps our ancestors, when we were running from the lions on the Sahara, had to crave pleasure so that you weren't eaten by the saber tooth. You had to hate pain so that you kept your hand out of the fire. Primitive survival instinct, still running the show in more sophisticated ways. I don't know that much about developmental biology or brain science, but some of the people that I teach with do, so I pick up little pieces. There's all of this study about how the human mind actually works and how kind of what the Buddha was saying is true and scientifically proven. I'm told that there's, in some ways, that we have three brains, that there's this the brain stem, which is sort of the original in the evolution of what has become the human mind. The brain stem was the first brain that is does motor functions, maybe, kind of moves the, lets us get the stuff into this hole in the front of our face, brain stem. And then there's on top of the brain stem the what they refer to as the, is it the neo, it's not the neocortex, it's, they refer to it as the reptilian brain, the lizard brain. And that's the part that has most of the craving and aversion, is in that reptilian, just above the brain stem in this little, very small part of the brain. And then this, you know, our big skulls were, that have been created for this big human brain, we call it the neocortex, the new brain, the new part of the brain. I said that actually the reptilian brain is the part that craves, that is running the show most of the time, and that there's a lot of thought that the main function of the neocortex, of our big human brain, is to rationalize and make up excuses for what the reptilian brain is telling us to do, for the cravings, for the aversions, that mostly what we use our big human brain for. Creating philosophies of why we're like this. Making up stories. Creating religions to explain why there's so much craving in this experience of being human. Why it's so hard to find satisfaction. The other two pieces of the second truth are that there is this craving for permanence. For a permanent being. And there is this craving sometimes for a permanent, for being, for existing. And then there's also sometimes a craving for non-being, for non-existence. Craving for being, I think, makes sense. It's that feeling of, okay, finally I got the right mixture. Everything's, for a moment here, it's all lined up. I've got the right amount of attention and stuff and I feel happy for a moment, and then there's this craving of, okay, now I just, if I can just hold on to this, I would like to be like this forever. It's all lined up for a moment. Can I create an extended, maybe that's one way that the Buddha was talking about craving for being. Also, I'm told that the craving for being and non-being was the Buddha's, somewhat he's putting it in the Four Truths, in response to the other philosophers of his time. Some who are nihilists, who are saying, that's it, one life, you die, lights out. And some are eternalists, who are saying, your soul continues forever, reincarnation forever. And as perhaps you know, the Buddha said, I'm the middle between the nihilists and the eternalists. I do not believe that existence continues forever, and I do not believe that it ends. And if you're craving for forever, you're going to be disappointed. That's not quite the way it works. And if you're craving for it to end, you're going to be disappointed. That's not quite the way it works. Neither being nor non-being. And if you're attached to either of these views or outcomes, you will suffer. Naturally, you'll suffer. Third truth, nirvana. Nibbana. craving can be extinguished, let go of, released. Sounds good. I'd like to release all of that in my life that causes difficulty. Nibbana literally is an ancient cooking term, an Indian Pali word that had to do with barbecuing on some level or another. It had to do with cooking over an open fire. And to Nibbana meant to remove whatever you were cooking from the fire. It's finished. Time for it to cool, to take it off of the fire. Nibbana. Didn't mean heaven. It didn't mean even enlightenment. It was just a term that meant Nibbana. Take it off of the burner. And the burner is greed and hatred and delusion, the fires of life. And so sometimes it's talked about as extinguishing the fires. Putting out greed, putting out hatred, putting out delusion. I like that. But I think it's more practical for us to think about it as removing ourselves from the fire rather than extinguishing those flames. Because as I proposed in the first night, those flames are also the hindrances. Those flames are also Mara. And if we actually are supposed to put them out so that greed never arises again in us, or hatred never arises again in us, it feels kind of unrealistic. But if what is being said to Nibbana is to remove your identification, to change our relationship so radically with greed and hatred and delusion, that the fires continue, but we're not getting cooked by them anymore. We're not getting burned by them anymore. Because as the Buddha said, I see you, Mara. I see the fire, and I don't put my hand in it anymore, but it's still there. It still arises. With mindfulness, greed arises, and we relate to it. Oh, greed again. Craving again. Aversion again. Of course. I believe this is enlightenment. Each moment that these fires arise in us, and we don't suffer about them. We don't get burned by them. This is not the popular Buddhist view. The religious Buddhist view is that if you're spiritual enough, you will no longer experience any form of greed or hatred or delusion. If you become enlightened, they will be extinguished completely. That might be true. I don't really know. I'm not enlightened, so how would I know? My years of meditation practice and the way that I've been able to change my relationship to craving and aversion and through mindfulness and forgiveness has made this view and my study of the Buddha's life has made this view make more sense to me. I'm not so attached to it, but it's what I think is true at this point. 10 years ago I thought something else was true, and 10 years from now I probably think something else is true. And that's okay. I think it's important for all of us to be open to impermanence in our views, our perspectives, even on ultimate truth, even on the goal. What we're doing in meditation is we're changing our relationship to our minds, to our bodies, to this world, to each other. We're changing our relationship to suffering, the cause of suffering. And hopefully experiencing more and more of the end of suffering, of Nibbana, of the moments where it's very painful and instead of hatred, we meet it with compassion. Liberation does not mean that there is no pain. It only means that there is no suffering. In the Buddha's life, he experienced a lot of stress. After his enlightenment, he experienced a lot of physical pain. He became elderly and injured. His cousin for many years was trying to murder him. Devadatta, his blood relative who had become a monk, was jealous, was creating difficulties in the community, and began assassination plots against him. And at one point even, it is said, tried to push a boulder onto him, and he was able to get out of the way, but it smashed his foot. And so then for the later part of his life, he had to kind of hobble around with a smashed foot from his own student and relative trying to get him. I think this is really important for you, for all of us. No matter how spiritual you get, no matter how enlightened you become, even the Buddha had to deal with some drama, with some difficult relationships, with people being angry at him and hating him, wanting to kill him. Have you had sometimes the idea that if I was really perfect, everyone would love me? If I could just be good enough, if I could just somehow, everyone would love me. No way. No possible way. There will always be those who love us and those who despise us, even if it's despising us out of delusion. There will always be praise and there will be blame. There will be gain and there will be loss. There will be pleasure and there will be pain. And these, what are called vicissitudes, are not the cause of suffering. How we relate to these vicissitudes is whether we suffer or not. Not the pleasure and the pain, not the praise or the blame. But if we can mindfully meet and respond wisely, whether or not we will be happy. If you need to be praised in order to be happy, good luck. If you can't be happy while being criticized, while being blamed, you're not truly free yet. And I'm not truly free yet. Somebody recently wrote an article about me I didn't like very much, and I suffered about it quite a bit. I like the praise. I really don't like the blame. And so interesting to see how, for me, to see how my mind works. I've had all of this praise of I've been teaching. I remember when my first book came out, I got great book reviews. One bad review. My mind does not recall a single thing that the positive reviews said. Just that they were positive. I can remember word for word the criticism. The mind retains it. Like Jake was talking about last night, that was painful. Let me try to avoid that. Let me remember that. Let me keep opening this gift, looking at it. I don't think, at least I hope, that enlightenment is not a myth. I think that probably our definition of enlightenment is often based on myth. I even say, I'm not enlightened. Because I have an idea that it's a perfection. This third truth, I don't think it's a myth. I think that it's accessible in each moment that we let go. And that the more we become successful and the more we progress at letting go, the more we will live in Nibbana. Or the less we will put ourselves back into the fire of samsara. Samsara, the Buddhist term for the cycle of wandering endlessly or seemingly endlessly through the fires, through the burning realms. The fourth truth is our prescription. Sometimes the Four Noble Truths are talked about in a medical, Ayurvedic, Indian medicine. There's a disease called suffering. There is the symptoms are grief and anger, and there is a cause, there is a treatment, there's a cure, Nibbana, there's a cure for the suffering. And here's the treatment plan, the eightfold path, the fourth truth. Eight areas of life to end suffering, to be followed, to be developed. Maybe it's most simple to just break it down, the eightfold path, into the three sections. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Sila translates as something like ethical behavior or sometimes morality, but just wise conduct. And it includes speech, actions, and livelihood. There is karma in our speech, in our actions, how we earn money. To be wise and careful with our speech, our actions, and how we are earning money is necessary in order to find freedom. The Buddha said trying to gain Nibbana, to extinguish greed, hatred, and delusion, or at least transform our relationship to them, without sila, is like being in a rowboat trying to get across the lake or the canal or the river. It's like it being in a rowboat, trying to get across while your boat is still tied to this side, to the dock. I take that to mean you can do a million meditation retreats. You can meditate all day, every day. And if your speech and actions and livelihood are not in line, in a wholesome, non-harming, loving, generous, skillful, then of course you will not make progress across the stream, across the river. Meditation by itself is not enough. And so I'm saying this also to the people who are leaving and to the people who are staying. We have to train our minds in mindfulness, and then we have to be mindful of what we're saying and why we're saying it, of what we're doing and why we're doing it, doing our best to align our speech and our actions and our livelihood from a place of kindness, from compassion, from generosity, or at the very least, from a place of non-harming, non-greed, and non-ill will, non-hatred. The five precepts that are traditionally prescribed for us non-monastics, non-monks and nuns, are to abstain from killing any living beings, and can be interpreted of living a life of non-violence. To abstain from stealing, and can be interpreted as living a life based not only on not taking, but on giving, a life of generosity. Not lying, a life of truthfulness, of integrity, of honesty. Not causing harm with our sexuality, a life of using our bodies in skillful ways, in wholesome ways. Enjoying sex when it's appropriate, when it's mutual and it's not going to cause harm. Enjoy it. But also know that this craving we have, so often physical craving, so often causes harm to ourselves or to others. Be really careful with our sexuality. Mostly, I think, in support of the first four precepts, also the Buddha encourages abstinence from drugs and alcohol. And it's been proposed quite a bit that one of the reasons that he says let's not drink or get high is because if you drink or high, you're more likely to steal, lie, hurt someone, and have sex with someone you shouldn't. And that there's not a sort of moral judgment on drugs or alcohol, but it's in support of the other ethical behaviors, because it's probably easier to be a bit more mindful and heedful, what we call heedful, or renouncing, to abstain. It's a bit easier when you're not intoxicated. When you are intoxicated, it becomes less, what do they say, inhibitions. some inhibitions are good. It's good to have some inhibitions. Sila, choosing a profession that doesn't cause harm. The Buddha only named a few. He said, better idea not to be a drug dealer. Good idea not to be an arms dealer selling weapons, or to sell flesh, which is considered maybe both like something like being a butcher or being a involved in selling sexuality, selling people. Better not to be involved in those trades, perhaps. Samadhi is what we're doing here. Meditation, concentrating the mind to penetrate to reality, to mindfully see the impermanent, impersonal, and often unsatisfactory nature, to gain liberation, to come into harmony with impermanence, to learn to respond with forgiveness, with compassion, with kindness, to enjoy pleasure as it comes and goes. Samadhi. This is our samadhi practice here. The effort of bringing attention back over and over to the present. Connect, sustain, see clearly. Panya is the wisdom factors. Translates as wisdom. And it's actually where the Eightfold Path starts. It starts with panya, understanding and intention. Having a wise wisdom understanding of the world, and having a wise wisdom of our intentions of how we're going to live our lives. Wisdom comes from the insight of samadhi. Some of it's philosophy, and we're, you know, talk about these teachings. But the important wisdom, the important panya, is the wisdom that you have as you sit here on the cushion, and you walk, and you eat mindfully, and you see your mind clearly, and you see your life's patterns clearly, and you see for yourself from the inside, aversion to pain doesn't work, but softening around it and meeting it with compassion does work. And that is the panya, that is the understanding that is most important, your direct understanding. All of the Dharma revealed right here in this body. All of the wisdom that you need revealed right here in your own direct experience, if we pay close enough attention for a sustained amount of time. I think one of the reasons why we have these retreats and they're about 10 days often. Somebody asked me recently, why are they always 9, 10 days, a little over a week? I didn't really know the answer. There's some history about a Goenka Ubakin kind of sending Goenka out to teach these retreats. And as I said the other night, that first retreat that he taught in India with Wes Nisker and Ram Dass and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and all these, Lama Surya Das. It's the first time, I think maybe Ubakin or Goenka said, 10 days, that's a good amount of time, that's the amount of time that it will take to develop some wisdom, some insight, some panya. And I was thinking back in the scriptures, why is that? And there's one place when someone asked the Buddha how long it takes to get enlightened. And his first answer is 7 years. Because it took him 7 years. Right? He left home and went out and practiced for six, so it was about 7 years. And then he came to liberation. So his first answer was, you know, you could do it in 7 years. That was my best time. That's my record so far, 7 years. And then he thinks about it for a little while and he says, no, no, if you're really sincere, if you practice incredibly effort and you have the right guidance. He said, for me, I had no guidance. It took me a while to figure it out myself. But here you have the Four Noble Truths. You have the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If you apply these teachings really skillfully, you could do it in 7 months. Thinks for a little while and he says, even that's too long. 70 days. And thinks and he says, okay, final answer. This is it. 7 days. If you apply sustained mindfulness and concentration for 7 days straight without your mind wandering. Then you will have liberating insight into the impermanent, impersonal, and unsatisfactory nature of all things. You will be liberated. You will experience Nibbana. Just 7 days. Of uninterrupted mindfulness, you will have all of the wisdom you need. Of course, here we are. Many of us have done dozens of 7, 10 month, 3 month retreats, never quite stringing together those 7 days in a row, or even 7 hours in a row, without becoming completely lost in our fantasies, suffering. Is to be fully known. We could even say embraced, turned towards, seen clearly, no longer ignored, no longer avoided, no longer denied. It's why Jack Kornfield said on that first retreat that I did, that at some point you may weep uncontrollably. Because when we really turn towards the grief of living in this impermanent world, where we lose everything that we love, we love everything that we've lost, where there's so much pain, there's so much difficulty, and there's so much beauty, but you can't hold on to it. The human body often needs to cry in response to the loss of living in anicca, the impermanent realm. The cause of most of our difficulties is craving. For life to be different than it is, The cause of most religions in the world is craving for life to be different than it is. We create stories and philosophies and psychologies and even, I think, some forms of Buddhism in a response to wanting this world to be different than it is, to living in a fantasy of how we think it should be, and creating heaven and creating hell and creating retirement plans and insurance. Insurance of every kind, just in case something happens. You'll feel secure. Have a backup plan. The end of suffering is possible in this lifetime. The Buddha was clear about this point. You don't have to wait. This isn't a layaway plan for enlightenment. This isn't, you know, be good in this lifetime and next lifetime you'll have an easier time of it. It was quite clear about the ability for human beings through mindfulness, through concentration, having the wisdom and the ethical behavior to find happiness in this lifetime, no matter what your life's experience has been. One of the common examples is of the serial killer Angulimala, who had murdered many, many people. He came to the and had some really bad karma, worse than yours, way worse. And he came to the Dharma and he practiced and he gained liberation in that lifetime. After killing maybe 100 people in that lifetime, he was able to purify that, to come to compassion, to come to forgiveness, to come to wisdom. If he can, we can. And if I can, you can. For sure. Not that I'm free, but so much progress from these practices. They work. Nibbana is the ability to chill out, removed from the fire, cooling. The Eightfold Path is to be lived, a life of righteousness and of honesty, of nonviolence, a life of love and service and engagement. The Buddha spent his 7 years getting enlightened and then spent 45 years being an engaged social, political activist. Spiritual activist. It's not right for everyone, but it makes sense for very many people that of course you want to create positive change in this world. That the outcome of your wisdom is compassion for all living beings. And then that you see, how can I help? How can I help? How can I bring a positive change? There's so much confusion in this world. Greed is so pervasive. War, so common. How can I use my life's energy to benefit all living beings? It's a good question. I don't have the answer for you, but it's a good question that each of us should ask ourselves on one level or another. And it might be small ways. It might be simple ways. There you have it. My version of the Eightfold Path and the Four Truths of the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching. May you reflect on these teachings and find out for yourself what is true.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.